We meet the leaders pushing South Dakota to new frontiers from SDPB. Today is Friday, October 18th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, three South Dakotans are among this year's Bush Fellowship cohort. Amber Zora is an interdisciplinary artist in Rapid City who focuses her artistic lens on veterans, women, and war. David O'Hara of Augustana University discusses sustainability and inspiring the next generation. And Lily Mendoza, founder of the Red Ribbon Skirt Society, talks about her work in advocating for missing and murdered Indigenous persons as she previews the incredible journey on which she is embarking. Plus, artist Claire Lockhart says she's not a vampire. Her legacy portraits may say otherwise. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A new exhibition explores the paintings and personas of artist Claire Lockhart's ancestors. Not a Vampire will have an opening reception on Saturday, October 19th at the Coyote Gallery in Vermilion. I connected with Lockhart earlier this week. We talked about choosing your family, creating a sense of belonging for yourself, and why all of the figures in her paintings now seem so similar.
This exhibition includes 10 oil on canvas portraits, and they're painted in a way that I think most people would associate a classic portrait, and they span throughout history. So starting in the Italian Renaissance, going through the Age of Piracy, and ending in the totally awesome 1980s. And I am officially telling everybody, these are my ancestors.
It's not really you at different times in life.
Nope.
Because you are not a vampire.
No, I am not.
Let's talk about portraiture as you have studied it. And, you know, you go into any classic art museum and you will see all these portraits. Has it fallen out of favor to have portraiture done? Tell us about how you think about the history of portraiture.
I can't tell you how many times I have read or heard art historians or critics or everyday people just say, ooh, portraiture is dead. It's easy to make a painting of a person. And as a person who has made many paintings of other people, it is in fact difficult. But I have to include some art theory and crit with it to make my work valid, which is why I'm saying this exhibition is an installation in and of itself. It's not just portraits. It's the whole installation. And on top of that, I've also included a selfie station. So that way, when people come and see the show, they get to be part of the exhibition. There are little replica frames that match what's on display. And so people can snap their own photos and be part of this ongoing portraiture experience.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about uncovering these ancestors and some of the time frames that you wanted to visit, including, oh, let's start with piracy.
Oh.
Because that's a fun place to start always, right?
Oh, you are right, matey. It is delightful. That was actually one of the first paintings I made. Oh, oops, sorry. I meant to say one of the first paintings I discovered, and it's my ancestor, Clara the Red, who was a fearsome pirate. And it's just so much fun to discover these paintings. I love that you get to be in on my joke.
Yeah.
But to have all these paintings with different eras of history that people can glance at and relate to, that's one of the things that I really love about portraits and in artwork, because I can look at paintings by other artists from across the world, different times, different languages, and I can still connect with them without even knowing who the artist was or who the subject was. And that's one of the fun things about having these long eras in history all in one place, because it's just a way for people to relate to the art and relate to that humanity.
We make eye contact with a portrait. The portrait, the person who's being painted, looks out at us. And that compels us to see ourselves in that time. What did you learn from these people looking out at the canvas at you, or what might the gallery goer experience as Claire's relatives stare at us from the walls from all these different times?
There's so many layers within my artwork. So I have this seriousness and this goofiness, and I hope people get a grasp of my sense of humor or my humanity as a person. And I think that is timeless, which is part of the fun of expressing my relatives all the way back hundreds of years at the start of when oil painting as we know it today began.
Pick another character in another time frame that you want to talk about what their life might have been like.
Oh, I have one of a flapper. Her name is Lula, and she's got that gold and black sparkly outfit with a little bell hat. And that's an era of the 1920s, which is really important, particularly for women in the United States, because that's when women were able to be allowed to vote starting with the 19th Amendment. And so that was an era when women could be rebellious. And there was, of course, a lot of backlash and pushing against it. And that's a very relatable era because 100 years later, it feels like we're still fighting for our rights and our humanity and being able to participate in our civilization as equals.
Oil on canvas and the time frame with which you discovered all these paintings. How does that process of building this exhibition for people to experience this work, you know, what did you learn about that? What did you learn about yourself as an artist when you were doing this project? Because they're all within a fairly short period of time that they were created / discovered.
I am a person who makes my own fun, apparently. I spend a lot of time working by myself, painting, and I started these paintings. Okay, I'll drop the facade. I started these paintings in 2020 when we were at the start of the pandemic, before we had tests accessible, before we had vaccines, and my ability to work with models was gone, but I still needed to continue to work. And while I was working on these paintings, which I am claiming are my ancestors, I was very careful in the choosing of the names. Some of them are very silly. When people come see the exhibition, hopefully this Saturday, October 19th, from 3 to 5 at the gallery in Vermilion, they'll notice on the frames there are those cheesy little placards engraved in metal with everybody's name.
Right.
And some of them are just silly variations of my name, but a lot of them are named after my friends who are incredibly important to me. And part of this exhibition is about exalting the concept of chosen family.
Say more about that.
I sometimes will feel very lonely, and then particularly at this era in history when we were in isolation. And so it helped me reflect on the relationships that are important to me, who I value. And chosen family is this amazing concept where our friendships are so important and vital to who we are as people. And even though this exhibition is silly, I hope that my respect and honor for the friends I have in my life comes through. And that's also part of the reason I'm inviting people to be part of this exhibition with that self-portrait station, so that way they can take photos and be part of it. These paintings end in the 1980s. I have nothing from the 21st century in it yet. So I want my friends to take part of this and proclaim that they are part of my family, my chosen family.
When we talk about selfies and putting yourself in a portrait, which you have done multiple times in, you know, Thunderdome SSD and other works, you're not afraid to stand in front of the camera or on the canvas and envision yourself in different ways. I almost imagine you sometimes jumping into the canvas and jumping back out of it, right? With this aplomb that only you can seem to do.
So one of the things with my background is I've been a teacher, and a lot of times I like having my students create self-portraits. Mm-hmm. And it would be very hypocritical of me to make them do that without me doing it myself. And it is difficult. I am not photogenic, and I'm not as egotistical as hopefully people don't think I am, but I often create self-portraits because I'm expressing something that is part of me, and it's very relatable. If a friend or someone I've never met sees my artwork and then sees me, it helps express that humanity. And so as a teacher, as an artist, as a mentor, encourage people to incorporate themselves in their work. It doesn't have to be a literal representational portrait like what I do, but putting yourself in there, it's that honesty, that's that genuineness, that's that way to communicate with others.
That was Miss Art World South Dakota, Claire Lockhart. Her new exhibition, Not a Vampire, has an opening reception this weekend, 3 to 5 p.m. at the Coyote Gallery in Vermilion on Saturday, October 19th. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This year, three South Dakotans joined the 2024 Bush Fellowship cohort. After the next break, you'll hear my conversations with David O'Hara and Lily Mendoza. But first, we welcome Amber Zora. She's an interdisciplinary artist and a military veteran.
One of the reasons I applied was because I had to leave so much to curate or have the conversations that I wanted to kind of in the anti-war field. Okay. So I'd go and curate an exhibition or show my own work in places like Texas, Illinois, California, New Jersey, and applying meant that I was like, well, I could stay in South Dakota. Do people want to have these conversations in South Dakota? I was just was not sure, and that was like a big question that I let like the Bush Foundation know through the process. Was like, I don't know if people will be receptive to having these conversations here.
Yeah.
And like, where do I have them and how do I have them, and you know, how do I get the right people in the room so I'm not just, you know, preaching to the choir about these things.
Yeah.
So the first year, I will be traveling to different museums that curate war and trauma, or maybe more specifically, war and genocide. So this summer, I went to Auschwitz and did a six-hour study tour, kind of looking at the way that they present the artifacts of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And next year, I'll be going to the Hiroshima Peace Museum. And also on my list is the National Museum for Peace and Justice, which is informally known as the Lynching Museum in Alabama. And so I'll be looking at how different curators and artists have, you know, put together confronting these difficult histories.
This is work that you have done in depth before. Tell us a little bit about your background and your interest in militarism and how we look at war. As a veteran, when did you start thinking about these things?
I grew up in Yankton, South Dakota, and I joined the military about a year after high school. And that was, you know, access to resources, as many people join. And I was deployed to Iraq in 2006 and came back in 2007. And a lot of us were under 25. And you can't really analyze an experience like that while you're going through it.
And the Army?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I was in grad school, it was kind of like towards the end of my time in service. And I was like, what was that? You know, like, why did we go there? And seeing like so many of my friends harmed by their deployments, like, you know, that was when I was like really analyzing, like, is anybody else talking about this?
Was anyone talking about it in Iraq? Were you talking about it?
No.
No, you're just doing your job.
Mm-hmm.
What was your job?
I was an ammunition specialist.
Okay.
I had joined as a cook. I was like, oh, this will be easy. I'll just have to wake up early. I'll be like...
How did you go from being a cook to an ammunition specialist?
I was reclassed. So I came back from AIT and they needed ammunition specialist. It was during like the troop surge.
So how long did you enlist for? When you first signed up?
I was in the Army Reserve, and I was 6 years, like, active reserve, and then 2 years IRR,
inactive ready reserve.
Yeah.
Okay. So then you got called up for a full year of active.
Yeah.
So you were thinking at the time, what did you think your commitment was going to be when you joined?
I just thought, like, I don't know, the TV commercials. Like, at the time, what was the saying? Like one weekend a month,
two weeks a year. Yeah.
Is that still the same? I'm not sure. And then I ended up just being in the reserve for 8 years.
So active duty, nobody's really actively talking about this. You're doing your job, you're getting home, but you're mm-hmm. watching things unfold. Do you take notes? Were you journaling? Were you documenting with photographs? As an artist, how were you seeing that time? Did you bring that artist with you into the combat zone?
When I separated from the military, I was like, donated everything to like the thrift store. I was like, okay, that part of my life's over, and like yeah. felt like I'm running in the other direction, like not wanting that experience to stay with me.
Yeah.
And then when I was in grad school, I realized that people hadn't met anyone that had been deployed. And I was going to like school at Ohio University, so a state school in the middle of the U.S. And people were like, I don't know anybody that was deployed.
Yeah.
During like the global war on terror, doing air quotes. And so it was interesting as like to be like, oh, like I have an experience that a lot of people haven't had or interacted with.
And then you're female too, which yeah. you and I both know shrinks the pool of people who have a shared experience considerably.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, what are you studying in grad school? Photography?
Mm-hmm.
As an artist, you're growing as an artist, and then you have this life experience. When did you start exploring it more?
Well, I had gone to like the library and I was like, surely someone's done this before.
Yeah.
I'm like searching JSTOR, you know, like trying yeah. to find anyone that's like written about it or like, and I couldn't find that artist or those mm-hmm. academics. And my grad thesis was photographs either from my time in service or ones I'd taken during grad school that kind of referenced a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I had written out stories from my time in service and made recordings that people could put on headphones and listen to while they were like walking through the space.
Yeah.
And those were like the best stories. So then after grad school, I was like, can I still make work? Like, I don't know.
Right.
like, because I don't want to just focus on my own handful of stories, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like, oh, well, what other perspectives are not being included? When I was talking to other kind of veterans, we started kind of expanding the work that we were looking at to include people that weren't just service members, but those who had been impacted by U.S. wars. So
mm-hmm.
people from the greater Middle East that were making artwork about U.S. occupation.
This is difficult stuff to look at. And to your point, the question is, do people want to have this conversation? What are you learning about people's willingness in South Dakota to sit and have a conversation about the impact of American military actions worldwide?
I tend to think that it works the best with like one-on-one conversations.
Okay.
When you start getting like a group of people together to talk about it, it's, I don't know, like things get like a little bit more complicated.
Sure.
I mean, everything's political, but then it starts becoming more about, like, instead of individual experiences, about state figureheads, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. When you have that conversation in the public space, you're judged publicly for, yeah,
mm-hmm.
interesting. Is art then a way to help people impacted by war, including veterans, tell some stories in a different way?
I think people are more receptive to hearing those stories when it's through art. I mean, I often think about that question of like, is the art that is on display for the artist or for the audience? And obviously it's both, but like, which way does it lean? But I think that we, as artists, we are translators for what's happening in the world. And I've had people come up to me and say, I knew exactly what you were talking about with that work, because they were in the military as a woman, et cetera. So I think sometimes, too, like people can process their own experiences as well as like understand how somebody else is affected by a certain policy, or like they can understand the world a little bit larger and see humanity in a different light.
When you go somewhere, when you go to a museum, when you go to the Arctic, when you go on a journey,
mm-hmm.
how do you prepare to document, note take, create in the space that you're at, bring things home? How do you make the most of that experience?
I mean, you have to just be open to, like, however it shakes out a little bit, like, yeah. You know, because you don't have that kind of control, especially if it's a, you know, a flight that's canceled or something. Mm-hmm. I always bring a journal and I write in it every day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it has nothing to do with what I'm looking at, which could be frustrating. Like, wait, where was I that day? What glacier was I looking at? I bring a sketchbook as well. And prior to going on these trips, I tend to read a lot of books that people have written about the place that I'm going. For instance, when I went to the Arctic, I read Frankenstein. Like, it's kind of like not related sometimes. But it also makes it like a little bit more, I don't know, it makes it more interesting to me.
How was Frankenstein in conversation with the Arctic?
That's the opening scene.
Is that why you chose it? Or were there other ways that it was surprisingly in conversation with the landscape?
Well, like the descriptions of the landscape within Frankenstein, running across the ice and
yeah.
The questions about just because we can invent something or explore somewhere, does that mean that we should?
Let me ask you this. You work with a lot of other veterans.
Mm-hmm.
When those people are making art and you're curating, they trust you. If you have served in the military, there is an expectation of patriotism and pride. Mm-hmm. That you might still carry with you, but it has become, once your service is complete, almost universally way more complicated than you thought it would be when you signed up. That's the nature of a bunch of 18-year-olds or 20-year-olds mm-hmm. signing up to serve their country and then finding out what exactly that means.
There's contradictions there, for mm-hmm. sure. If you're a veteran artist and an anti-war veteran artist, it can be difficult to get like an honest, like to have like an honest conversation about your work because it's a very precarious place to be.
Yeah.
I think that we can talk about our experiences in the military and get there much more quickly mm-hmm. than if we were talking to somebody that has never experienced military service.
Right.
So I think that like one of the reasons why people have asked me to curate veteran art is because I like, you know, I know the field of like not just veteran artists, but other artists who discuss war in their work. And so I can like kind of guide and help like artists that, you know, like I can kind of like give advice to artists in a way that might be more receptive because I was in the military versus like, I don't even know, civilian curator. Is that a that people maybe like can trust. I'm there to hear their experiences.
Are there questions that you come back to again and again as you reflect on your experience? Things that you just are always asking yourself or things that you wish you understood or knew? What are the questions that just will not let go?
One of the things I've been thinking about a lot recently is like what kind of leadership style that I have. Because I don't feel comfortable like behind this microphone or on a podium or being like that person. Like I never really considered myself a leader specifically in this way. I'm always the person that's doing like logistics, making sure that everyone has like enough to eat and has their plane tickets figured out. I'm always like the kind of person behind the scenes. And so trying to figure out like, you know, I wanted to move towards doing some classes or lessons that would be like communication skills and these, you know, like public speaking, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, wait, but like, I mean, I need those things, but like, what is like most genuine for me and my leadership and like a leader that's in service to other people?
Yeah.
So that's like a question that I keep thinking about. Like, do I take on what I think might be weaknesses to make myself a stronger leader, or do I lean into what I think I do really well?
That was artist and curator Amber Zora. She's a member of the 2024 Bush Fellowship Cohort. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Before the break, you heard Amber Zora, one of South Dakota's 2024 Bush Fellows. Now let's hear from the other two South Dakota Fellows, beginning with David O'Hara. O'Hara is a professor, an environmentalist, and an advocate for sustainable change. He teaches at Augustana University, where he is a professor of philosophy, classics, and environmental studies. He's also the director of sustainability there. We talked with him in July. David O'Hara, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori. It's great to be with you, as always.
This is another situation where I think I know so much about you because of the years that we've been in conversation, but I don't know much about your family. And in your Bush Fellowship reporting, it talks about the influence of both your parents. So I would love to hear more about your mom and dad and some of the things that they taught you growing up that are still impacting the way you see the world today.
Oh, yeah. I feel very fortunate to have had such amazing parents. My mom was driven by a desire to see good things happen for other people. She worked as director of rehabilitation at the county jail in our little rural county in upstate New York for 25 years. And people there came to know her as Mother Nancy because she was always looking to get people their GED, get into rehab, do whatever they needed to do to get back on their feet and live productive and healthy lives. And some of my memories from my dad raising me are him teaching me things like how to repair things rather than throw them out, how to walk in the woods quietly and pay attention to what was around me, and both my parents, how to grow my own food, how to build things with my hands. I'm really grateful for those lessons.
Was there a time that you felt, because not all of us take the things that our parents taught us and make them our own, was there a time that you felt like this is influencing me, but it is also worth keeping in the world? Like, were you in college? Were you an adult? Was it always part of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think the things that I saw in my parents, the things that I've just talked about, are things that from my brother and sister and me from our earliest years we valued. We all went through our rebellions. I mean, what kid doesn't, right? But those things that I just named, I think, are all things that even when we were little, we thought, these are things that we want to continue. And each of us, my brother and sister and I, have kind of done them in our own way. But yeah, our parents gave us a lot of good gifts, and we want to give those gifts to our children and to our communities.
Why the Bush Fellowship for you? What was the moment where you thought, this is something I'm going to apply for, and this is the right time for me to apply for it?
Well, one thing that makes the timing easy is I happen to have a sabbatical upcoming. So I thought, and I'm on sabbatical right now. Why not start to do something new with a sabbatical? Sabbatical is about renewal and about deepening what you have and starting over. But I've also had some good role models, like a certain radio host that I know, and one of my colleagues, Willett Capers, somebody that I'd never met personally, but I know online, David Whitesock. Others kept saying to me, "You should apply for this. You should apply." So I decided, yeah, this year I'm gonna go for it. I found the process of applying really helpful. It made me think about what is it that I really want to do with this next stage of my life.
Yeah, so did I. The process of, because it is an ongoing process. It's not one application.
Right.
It is months of reconsidering. You get a mentor and a guy to sort of look at some of your early thoughts and say, well, have you thought about this? Or sort of reframe things for you. I found that incredibly clarifying, as I also found the cohort itself to be so humbling and clarifying. And the things that they were saying to me during my fellowship, my cohort, were life-changing. Someone would say something, I'd be like, that just changed my life. Like, I didn't see it like that, and you did. Are you having that similar experience after your first retreat?
Oh, my goodness,
of being with these people that are in your cohort?
Yeah. I mean, I went in there not knowing any of them, and I came out of it just feeling in awe. Like, why am I included in this company of amazing people with all these big ideas that they want to do? That's pretty fantastic. Yeah. And like you said, in the not just the retreat, but it was 9 months of application and just going through essays and meeting with people. And they ask questions like, what are you most proud of? And I got to say, you know, as a proper Midwesterner, even though I didn't grow up here, somebody asks you, well, what are you most proud of? And you're supposed to say, no, oh, I'm not proud. And they just pressed me on that. What am I proud of? Mm-hmm. And that got me thinking, well, I'm proud of my kids. I'm proud of my wife. I'm proud of the people that I work with and I've been able to hire. And honestly, proud of some of the things that I've been able to build. And now I want to do more of that. It was a good question to ask and good to have to confront that, you know, that kind of deep-seated resistance to saying that there are things that I'm proud of.
Yeah. I had a conversation with one member of the cohort, and I was talking about a work I wanted to do or a story I wanted to do, and I said, I just don't think that that's something I can do. Yeah. That would be too controversial or it would be too difficult. And he looked at me and said, but you have a license for that. Hmm. And I was like, journalists don't have a oh, wait, I know what you mean. And so sometimes just being challenged to see somebody else say, wait a minute, if you're a journalist and you're not going to do that thing, if you're not brave enough to do that story, we're relying on you to be the person who does it because you are a journalist. That is your license,
right,
is what he was telling me. And that's been incredibly, that's been an incredible mantle carry that expectation, help me see journalism in a new way.
Yep.
What are some of the things that you are planning on doing with your fellowship time?
Yeah, so the biggest thing is I want to learn. I get to be a student again. This is a great thing. Every teacher should get to be a student again. So there are some things that I've been working on with my students for a long time. A lot of them have to do with sustainability. How do we make sure that the things that we've got right now in front of us, we can pass them on to the next generation in just as good or better form than we had? How do we be not just loving our neighbors, but loving those who will come after us too? I want to be a good ancestor. So I want to go around. I'm going to travel and visit the people who are doing the kinds of things that I think we could be doing. I see some big changes that we could make where the state could be setting a model for the world. And there are little bits and pieces that other people have done, but no one's kind of done the interdisciplinary work of putting them together. And I want to learn how to be the kind of leader who helps other people do that work. Mm. I don't need to make a name for myself. What I really want to do is help other people make the good kinds of changes that we could make here.
So talk about that as a professor. Mm. Because as I said before, I followed you for a long time. And you are consistent with your devotion to your students and helping them do what you just said. You will, after the sabbatical, continue to teach and help that next generation of people, whether it's at Augie or beyond in the community, as you often do. Why is that important to you? Why is teaching so much a part of who you are? Because not every college professor is there to be a teacher first. Many are there to do their own research. They get tenured, you know, and that's not an insult. I just, a student, you often can distinguish the professors who are there and you're really happy to learn alongside them and the professors who are so devoted to your development. Why is that important to you?
That's a great question. And you're right. I've got colleagues who are amazing researchers, so much smarter than I could ever dream of being. I just love being around students and watching these ideas kind of flourish and blossom in their minds and then saying, well, I've got some resources. As a teacher, I can help you to grow those ideas. Let's go back to my parents. My parents were both, in a way, teachers. They've both done a little bit of teaching, but they saw potential in other people and then helped to nurture it. And I saw that as a great model, and I just want to carry it on.
Yeah. I was in Hawaii last week for my final fellowship journey for a variety of reasons, including the fact that I lived there for 4 years, was stationed at the base, and had gone back to do some specific things. And one of the things that I was just undone by was the diversity of plant life.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost to the point where I didn't know what I was seeing until, because my experience in the Black Hills National Forest is, you know, it's very monoculture. I mean, there's a lot of pine trees, not entirely, but compared to what I saw in Hawaii, I was like, oh, this is what I'm seeing. How can these things be in the same place?
Yeah.
And then I realized what I was looking at was something I don't have language for because I'm not a scientist, but the diversity in plant life, the biodiversity.
Right.
I was seeing it for the first, I was seeing it anew.
Yeah.
And I thought of you and I thought, is it too late to save places like this? Is it too late when we talk about sustainability, when we talk about what we are willing to sacrifice as humans to protect things? Where do you come at that, the feeling that some young people have that the feeling of despair that too much has been lost.
Right.
You know, an endangered species wandered across the path from us.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is the first time I've seen an endangered species outside of a zoo.
Yeah.
Or a photograph.
Yep.
And here they are.
You and I have both been traveling. A couple of days ago, I was in the Pacific Ocean in Costa Rica working with some sea turtle scientists, helping them to do research on another endangered species, a species of sea turtle. And you could become overwhelmed when you realize just how much has been threatened. I mean, look at our Big Sioux River. It's kind of a mess. I don't want my kids drinking it. I don't want to swim in it right now. It used to be clear as glass, but a century or more ago. So yeah, you could get desperate. We've talked about this before. I'm a Christian. I'm a pragmatist. As a philosophy professor, I'm a little bit of a stoic, and I'm going to look at the world and say, yeah, there are some messes that I can't clean up. But right in front of me, I've got these students who have hope, who have good ideas, who want to love their neighbors as themselves, who want to be good ancestors. I might not be able to change everything, but I can encourage and foster the good things that are already alive right in front of me. And, you know, your experience in Hawaii, seeing that diversity of plants and diversity of flowers, animals, et cetera. Yeah, I get that too. And I want us to notice here in South Dakota that we aren't flyover country. Yeah. We are this immense, rich, gorgeous landscape. But so many of the lives here are really, really small. Like the native bees, not just the honeybees, but the native bees that live all by themselves and that don't sting, most of them. They pollinate our food. Yeah. And we don't even notice them. And so we spray insecticide and think, well, that must have been a mosquito or something because they're so small. And we depend upon them. I want us to get to know our neighbors, including the little bees, and to do what we can to care for them so that the generations that come later, my great-great-grandchildren, will look back and say, gosh, I'm glad that Dave did the things that he did.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to go really far away and to come back and look at your own backyard.
That's right.
Afresh.
Yeah, that's right. I think everyone should travel. Mm-hmm. Not everyone should be a tourist, but everyone should travel in order to learn and then come back and see the place where you live with fresh eyes.
Tell me about your writing practice as you travel. Yeah. Do you take field notes? Do you journal? Because I struggled with that. I was overwhelmed by all the things I was seeing, and then all of a sudden I was out of words.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, okay, you don't have to have all the words right now. But put a few things down, put some field notes, put some observations down, do a couple recordings.
Yep.
Trust that process. But it was inadequate to the task of the size of what. So you have more experience than I do in this. How do you keep a writing practice or a field note practice? What would you call it?
And, yep.
And let me peek inside that notebook for a minute.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I actually have a notebook in my pocket, and yeah. I always do. If somebody tells me their name, I write it down quickly. I write sketch notes. It doesn't have to be beautiful prose, whatever your middle school English teacher said. Just write stuff down right now. Don't wait until much later to catch up. I also carry a bigger notebook, which I've got right here next to me as well. I carry notebooks with me all the time. And when I get a chance to sit down in a coffee shop or something, I'll write for a few minutes and just kind of review the day. I want to make sure to review the day every day if I can. I also, when I was going in Costa Rica, I had 5 cameras with me, so I take pictures of insects. I set up trail cameras to kind of catch what's going by when I'm not looking. And I had a sketchbook. One of the art professors at Augustana put out this challenge this summer to take 20 minutes a day to sketch what you see. Not to do fine art. We don't all have to be Picasso or Van Gogh, just to sketch. And I find the practice of sketching for just a few minutes, of trying to draw what you see, winds up slowing you down and helping you to see better, even if you never show anybody what you sketched.
Yeah.
So your writing can be like that too. It's not about trying to write the great American novel or the great American nature work. I mean, I'm preaching to the choir, you know this, but we're trying to make sure that this thing that is right here in front of us right now doesn't get lost. When you're with somebody that you love, you take time to look in their eyes, right? Mm-hmm. You've seen their eyes before. Do you really need to look in their eyes? Yeah, you do. Like, you look in their eyes because there's that moment of deepening the connection, you know, touching their hand, whatever. Writing can be a little bit like that, too. It's a way of kind of looking in the eyes of what's around us right now. And if you allow yourself to slow down, not be distracted by all the other stuff, but to kind of gaze into the moment that's right in front of you by writing. It doesn't have to be beautiful prose. Here's a college professor telling everyone listening, it doesn't have to be beautiful prose, but just write it down and you've got something then to go back to and kind of deepen writing later on if you want to.
I want to leave people with this because for people who aren't familiar with your work, they don't know what you have been through in your life. And there was a time when you suffered a terrible accident.
Mm-hmm.
You were public about that, so I'm not revealing any secrets. And Did you think, were there days that you thought, I won't be able to do what you're doing right now?
Oh, yeah.
For the people who are in that spot now, help them understand how to get to the other side where they can do the thing.
Yeah.
Like, you might be having a really bad day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll fill in your listeners who might not know. I'm a cancer survivor, and I'm also somebody who was in a bad accident, traumatic brain injury, penetrating traumatic brain injury. I have some pretty bad brain damage. It left me unable to write. I couldn't type. I couldn't move a pen. I've studied a lot of languages, and I lost ability in all of them, including in English. And I had a lot of broken bones besides. And it was a long and slow process of recovery. Thankfully, I had a supportive community, mm-hmm. my wife, my children, my workplace. And little by little, I've tried to gain those things back. I'm not as good a writer as I was before. I'm not as good a speaker or teacher, I think, as I was before. But you know what? We all age. Everything changes. And that's what I have, I'm going to use. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as I've got these things, I've got a little bit of brain left.
A little.
Yeah, a little bit. I can't run as fast as I once could. I've got these injuries. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I have this amazing world. And I've got people that I enjoy talking to, that I enjoy teaching, and I get great hope from the thought that the people around me might do amazing things. I don't have to do amazing things. I just have to care about these people who someday might be doing something even greater. Let me leave you this anecdote. Last November, All Saints Day, as I was driving into work, I was thinking about, what does this mean, All Saints Day? It's like the day, the catch-all for all the other saints, right? And I was thinking about, there's all these people in all sorts of traditions that we think of as saints. Each one of them at one point was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I'm going in to teach a bunch of kids, you know, they're 18 to 22 years old, but kids in my classrooms. And it hit me, which one of them might someday, maybe 1,000 years from now, be thought of as a saint? And what's my role? If I get to be with that person today and help them just a little further along the way, I don't want to impede them, and I want to help their garden to grow. What can I do? That gives me hope. Yeah. That's why I want to teach. That's what my parents did for me. It's what I see going on in the world. I want other people to enjoy and participate in that too.
David O'Hara, Augustana University professor and environmentalist. He is now a 2024 Bush Fellow. Let's get to know Lily Mendoza a little better now. She's founder of the Red Ribbon Skirt Society, a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, and a 2024 Bush Fellow. I spoke with her in July. Lily Mendoza, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on air again.
And congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Hugely.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
I was so excited when I saw your name, seriously, Lily. And what drew you to the Bush Fellowship as a next step in your personal journey?
Well, you know, I was really actually encouraged by some young women to do this. Those women and other women that have been actively involved in the Red Ribbon Skirt Society and have seen my work in community, they're the ones that suggested that I really actually apply for the Bush Fellowship.
Yeah, the application process itself can be very intimidating, but also clarifying as you're asked deep questions about your leadership and what's in the way for you. What do you want to do in the future? Whose shoulders do you stand on? Big questions like that. How did the application process and the mentorship that you received during that time sort of clarify what you wanted to do with the opportunity?
Right. Yeah. You know, doing this work and applying really did clarify some things for myself as an individual and the work that I've been doing and where I want to go with that work. And a big part of the fellowship is about me and people that apply for it. It's about about yourself, you know.
Yeah.
And so it made me really take a hard look at that and to think about myself as a Lakota woman and what I can do for myself to help others in the work that I am doing. And a huge part of that, as I was completing the application and rewriting, is how I can heal myself in our Lakota life ways, really.
Mm-hmm. How hard was that? You're not starting from scratch.
No. I guess it just really made me take notice. It really made me take notice of the work that I'm doing. It made me take notice and reflect back on the women that have been very, very influential and powerful in my life from a child, and made me reflect back on watching them and the work that they did in community and their place in community as matriarchs.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? So how will you tell me some parts of your plan? And I know it's a comprehensive plan, so we're not going to unpack the whole thing for you, and some of it's private. But what are some of the ways that you're looking, moving forward and saying, big picture, I need to spend some time reflecting about this, or traveling here, or studying that? What's ahead for you?
Right. What I'll be doing actually is I will be going and visiting all of our sacred sites and spending time and reflection there on the land. I also will be meeting with elders and other Lakota women that are matriarchs and that know some of our ceremonial songs. That's a huge part of it. And although right now I do participate in ceremonies, having not learned my language growing up because we just weren't taught our language anymore, that'll be a big part of that. And I'm going to do that through song because it's a lot easier for me to learn through song. I have a degree in music, and so it's a little bit more familiar to me to learn that way. And so, yes, I'll be going to sacred sites all over South Dakota. One of my bigger adventures I will be doing is I will be walking in the Chief Bigfoot Ride in December. And starting that walk, it's a 300-mile walk, going to Wounded Knee. And a big part of that, everything that I'm doing is remembering, healing for our women, because that's what I do.
Yeah.
And so on this journey, I'm also really deeply looking into my own healing as well, because I can't help anybody if I can't heal myself.
Right. And that's hard to set a time frame on. Speaking from personal experience,
right,
you're like, okay, well, this is a detour that I didn't anticipate happening.
Right.
What do you know at this point about your cohort as you look at some of the people that have also been selected? You will go through this journey with them.
Right.
Do you have initial thoughts on the scope of that cohort and what they might bring to conversations with you to help you as you implement your own plan?
You know, I think, you know, when we had our retreat in Minneapolis, I was present there with a lot of young people, okay? Yeah. And as I heard their stories and what their plans were, it was like I was listening to my children, because I was the elder there, okay? And it was interesting to listen to their journeys and what an opportunity for these young people to begin this journey now. You know, I'm 66 years old, and I am just beginning this journey.
Yeah.
And it was pretty amazing to hear their stories, where they came from, their struggles, and where they want to be, you know. And my message to them was, you have a long road ahead of you. And if there's anything that I can do to help you on that journey, you know, just let me know.
Yeah. I respect and honor your journey. So thank you so much for stopping by again and sharing this part of it.
Thank you, Lori.
And that is our show for today. We hope that It Served You in the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. Our engineer is Colton Nicholson. You can find us on Instagram at SDPB News. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.